Thank you, Tim and company. That was good. I think we're going to move ahead. Joel, Shane, and Lowell just kind of move up this direction when one's done, and we'll see what we can learn about your work.
Mr. Z, a man who taught me a lot about the city and about the people there. That isn't the only distinctive, though, of Mr. Z. When I think of him, I tap into this deep well of tiredness, of frustration, of exasperation. And I'll tell you a little about how that came to be, how those two things came to be. I first met Mr. Z in a Bihari camp in Dhaka. The Bihari are Pakistanis, and after Bangladesh's War of Independence from Pakistan, it went from being at the top of society to being at the bottom. Well, I went with a Canadian friend one evening to visit some friends of his in the Bihari camp. And it's a really interesting place. It felt like I was entering the labyrinth. We walked through an opening between two shops, and suddenly there was this maze of concrete, a lot of one-room houses opening onto twisting alleyways. People did a lot of their living in the alleys. The boundaries between indoor and outdoor were really blurred in there. And one of the people we met in this camp was Mr. Z. Well, he quickly established himself as my Bangla shikok, my Bangla teacher. And that evening I made plans to meet him on Saturday morning. Well, several days later, on Saturday, the morning didn't go quite as planned. But at around 12 noon, we left for, several hours touring the city. Well, we went south. He got a rickshaw. We went south. We went past Newmarket, the southern end of my world at that point. And we kept on going, and we kept on going. And eventually we got to Lal Bagh Fort, a Mughal fort that was built in the 1600s. It was closed. So we went to his mother's house. They were opening at 2. We went to his mother's house, and we sat down and ate, which was interesting because this was during Ramadan. We weren't really supposed to eat. But Mr. Z introduced me to his sisters, encouraged me strongly to keep in touch with them. eventually we went back to the fort, getting there about the time that I had initially thought we might be winding down this excursion. And I enjoyed the tour of the fort. There, Mr. Z helpfully arranged for me to bribe the caretaker of the museum there, to take pictures inside the building. A fact which I realized sort of after the fact exactly what all had transpired. So we left the fort and the excursion went on. We went to one friend of Mr. Jehuda's in one part of the city, and showed off his American friend. And I got to meet some new people, and then we went to another friend's place, and to another friend's place, and another. And it was really an interesting time, but it was getting quite a bit past the length I had thought we were going to be touring the city. Well, We went past Buett, where some of our software engineers there, all of our software engineers, graduated. We went past Dhaka University, and we went past the Martyrs Monument. And at each place, we got pictures of Mr. Jehuda, and Joel. And I think some pictures of me. And, you know, he inspected and approved each set. Well, at about this time, it was getting close to dusk. And we went to another of Mr. Jehuda's friend's place. And we ate iftar there. As I think as soon as you cannot distinguish a white hair from a black hair, that's the time for the iftar meal, for breaking the fast. And I met several of his friends there, a fairly conservative gentleman with a bushy beard and no mustache. I met another person who was who had come to Dhaka to look for work. And I still keep in touch with that young man. But I enjoyed breaking the fast with them. I wasn't breaking my fast, and neither was Mr. Jehuda. But but it was a good time. And so, by this time, of course, it was well after dark. We went out. Mr. Jehuda asked for 100 taka note, around 70 cents, but a decent amount of money. Well, and I gave it to him, whereupon, instead of hailing a CNG, he charged his cell phone minutes, loaded minutes onto his cell phone. Well, we then got a CNG and headed for home. Well, or not for home. We stopped at yet another place. By this time, I think I'd communicated fairly clearly and fairly intentionally that I really was tired. I thought it was about time to wind down. But we stopped at the Parliament Building and saw some beautiful sights there and saw the tomb of the founder of the country. But at around 11 p.m., we finally got back to my flat. Mr. Jehuda accompanied me up, thoroughly inspected the flat and its contents, and eventually, after eating some snacks and having some water, asked for rickshaw fare home. And so I gave it to him. And this episode in my life with Mr. Jehuda ended. Well, this was, by the time all was said and done, a fairly frustrating experience, actually. I was tired perhaps 6 hours before the experience ended. But this was a really rich time as well, and gave me a lot of connections for my future life in the city, and still at least one connection that I maintain. So I did acquire a few lessons from this experience as I thought about it. One, being totally out of control, having your plans totally blown away, rarely will kill you. I don't really remember this experience as being a whole lot of fun, but at least as time went on. But it did provide a really rich base for my time in Bangladesh and ongoing connections. And though fairly quickly I started through that experience and in others with Mr. Z, I felt like he was milking the relationship for all it was worth and really was taking advantage of me. I realized that even in that sort of relationship, there can still be value. And another realization was that sometimes simply planning to have no control over what happens can be a great way to minimize frustration. I did realize in that experience, and again through some other experiences, that there are three things that play in tension, and that tension is not something that's resolved once and is then settled. But one is that I do need to assume the best of someone's intentions, and even that within the context, within their cultural framework, that they're doing the right thing. Just as a default assumption. Because we do think in really different ways from various other cultures. Second, I do have my own assumptions about the way things should be. And I need to work with those. But I can't totally abandon them. But I need to be aware of them and be willing to pressure them to be stretched into another culture. The third was sometimes people do simply behave badly by the standards of their own culture or of mine. And so that is a tension that is ongoing, that I think anytime you encounter a different culture, and there are, I think different cultures are closer than we know, than we often think. Even within this group, we have different cultures. But anytime you interact with a different culture, you need to assume the best. You do have your own assumptions about the way things are, and you need to work with them, but you need to examine them and be willing to be stretched. And sometimes people do simply behave badly. So that is my story. Those were the few lessons that I drew from it.
Well, I don't really have as much of a story as just kind of an overview of some of the things that we did. I do have a few specific stories about our time in Colorado that I'll be sharing. But just kind of wanted to look at some of the things that we did, look at some of the good things and a few of the not so good things, and how all of those, you know, do play in, as Romans says, that God works all things together for good. And the fun things and the not so fun things can be good learning experiences. Ken called me about 2 weeks after Dorcas and I were engaged and asked if we would consider coming to Colorado to work with Choice Books there. And we really hadn't given it a lot of thought until then, I guess. But we thought about it for a little bit, and it seemed like it was the right thing for us to do. We didn't know why, because the work of Choice Books wasn't particularly something that had electrified either of us. But we felt very clearly that God was calling us to go to Colorado and work there. So we said we would. So we got married in August, and on January 2nd of 2009, we packed up and moved to Colorado about 4 months after we were married. Choice Books, just to give you a little bit of an overview of how Colorado District operates and some of the nitty-gritty that we did. Choice Books LLC has a number of distributors, of which Kansas is one, and Colorado is a sub-district of Kansas. Dorcas and I, when we were there, serviced in the neighborhood of 100 displays, primarily in the Front Range of Colorado, but we also got into western Colorado and southern Wyoming and into Nebraska. What we did, each store has its own display, obviously, and we would go in and scan all of the books that were on the display, figured out which ones had sold, which ones had been sitting there for quite a while and were slow. If it had sold one, we tried to restock it. If it had been sitting there, we pulled it off and brought a new selection in, just trying to keep things fresh, looking good, and selling. And I know many of you know all about that. Perry's sitting up here grinning. One of my least favorite parts of the job were the hours. I don't know how many of you have worked with grocery store receiving hours, but they are not a thing of beauty. In order to get fresh food on the shelves, they like to get their stuff in early in the day, which makes a lot of sense. But our receiving hours for grocery stores typically range from 4 in the morning to 11 in the morning. So we had a pretty short window to get into our grocery stores, and if we were starting in Denver, we had about a 2-hour drive before we got there. And my wife will be happy to testify that I am not a morning person. And mornings can come for me at about 3:15, or they can come at 9:30, and they still feel a lot like mornings. The 9:30 mornings work better for me in the long run. So the getting up early was not something that I particularly enjoyed, but I did sort of get used to it. The Ministry of Choice Books is the vision, the purpose is to provide inspiring and wholesome reading material for shoppers across the United States. And basically they're taking inspirational literature and putting it in front of people that would not seek out, you know, Christian bookstores or something like that. Most of what we sell is impulse purchase, and we do get feedback from people that say, you know, they picked this up on a whim and it was exactly what they needed. So the primary ministry of Choice Books is to get wholesome reading material in front of the hands and eyes of people that need truth, that need encouragement, and that need alternatives to unwholesome reading material. And I was just really impressed. We sold a number of titles that, you know, were maybe not on par with your Bibles. But compared to a lot of the things that were on the shelves right next to our racks, you know, it looked like pretty wholesome reading material. I was impressed with how much junk is sold and how providing an alternative to that is a good thing. Just in kind of a candid moment, I am a very results-oriented person. And it was frustrating for me to be in maintenance mode. You know, we went to the same stores every 3 weeks and serviced the racks. And the time that we were working with Choice Books was a pretty bad time economically. And so sales were down quite a bit. And it felt like we were spinning our wheels sometimes. Another part of the frustration was that I got very little interaction with the people that were actually reading the books. You know, we would sell books, and occasionally we would talk to people that had read them, but most of the time we didn't have much idea, you know, how it affected people that bought our books. And that was frustrating for my results-oriented brain. But that frustration led me to approach our work in at least two different ways. one of the ways I dealt with my frustration with not relating with the end user was by prioritizing relating to the people that we did see. At every store, we had somebody that checked us in. And those were the people that we had opportunity to relate with, to impact. And I just have one example. There are a couple people that are kind of highlights for me in the receivers that we interacted with. And ironically enough, the one that I'm going to tell you about is probably the crankiest one of our entire 100-plus stores. Ken and Brad had both warned us had mentioned that this lady at Fort Carson, an Army post in Colorado Springs, is just phenomenally grouchy. And they weren't kidding. But it was kind of interesting. I kind of made it my personal mission to do two things. Number one, I wanted to get her to like us. And number two, I wanted at least once in the year and a half that we were there to get her to smile. And so at first we would walk in and, you know, we'd walk past the check-in desk. We'd come in the back of the store, walk past the check-in desk and go to inventory the rack. And she'd usually be sitting there, you know, typing on the computer or sorting something and mumbling and muttering and throwing things around. And I would just look at her and say, "Hi, Lisa." And at first she would just, you know, keep mumbling and muttering and throwing things around or typing, and she completely ignored us. And between 6 months and a year after we were there, she kind of started, you know, looking up when we came. And eventually she would, you know, stop mumbling and muttering and throwing things long enough to, "Morning," you know, and then she would go back. I don't ever specifically remember getting her to smile, but she didn't dislike us. And it was fun coming in there and trying to brighten her day. And she almost always cheered me up, partly because I would be intentional about being cheery when I got there. And when I was grouchier than Lisa, I knew that it was time to change. And those days did happen. But she was a highlight. Just another, there isn't much of a moral to this story, but I really enjoyed it. We had another receiver who was, he was a retired Navy officer, and he was used to telling people what to do and how to do that, and diplomacy was not very high on his list of priorities. So there were two receivers that worked in the back of the store, and we usually worked with one who was not particularly bubbly, but he was very nice. But Bill would often be checking in either the Coke products or the Pepsi products when we were there. And so we would often be hanging out in the back with the Coke and the Pepsi guys. And these poor guys, according to Bill, always brought in too much product. You know, they had 11 pallets. "Well, you're only supposed to have 9. You know, and he'd start counting off and whatever. And he always found something to gripe about. And he was another one that, you know, for some reason, chronically grouchy people kind of amuse me. But one of the last times we were there, the Pepsi guy was checking in, and they had found, Bill had some problem with the invoice. And so it was kind of a game for all of the vendors back there to, you know, kind of, I mean, we kind of played with Bill. And the Pepsi guy made some kind of snarky remark, you know, after everything had been cleared up, whatever. He said, "Yeah, Bill, I'm a Pepsi genius." And he paused a little bit and said, or "Is that an oxymoron?" "Well, the moron part is right." So several lessons that we learned looking back on our time in Colorado, the things that God leads us to and through are not always fun things. I missed one part that I wanted to talk about. Another way that my view of the job changed was I started doing some sales work on the side. After we were done servicing for the day, I would do some cold calling at hospitals and truck stops. Those were the two places that I tried to target the most, but different types of places. And I really enjoyed sales work. I enjoyed the challenge of trying to convince managers that were not convinced that they really did need this display in their store. And with the sales arrangement that Choice Books offers, it really was a no-lose proposition for the retailers. And so it was fun to present that to people and see if they could see it my way. And my results-oriented brain was gratified in some of those things because I did have some places that agreed to bring in Choice Books displays. And it was fun to check that up in the win column. One of the most fun places that I sold was a hospital in Denver that in April, I think, the last sales numbers were turned out from Choice Books LLC, the nationwide organization. That hospital is the fourth highest selling hospital gift shop in the organization. So that, you know, those things kind of gave me some of the milestones that I needed or that I'd like to have. But the things that God leads us to and leads us through are not always fun things. But he takes us where he wants us to be. And, you know, there were a number of days when we were servicing and I was bored that I really just felt like quitting. But I couldn't ever quite get around the fact that God had called us where we were. And that if he had called us there, we were probably supposed to be there for some reason. And that if we were supposed to be there for a reason, we probably should be putting ourselves into it when we were there. So that was one lesson that I learned. I'm sure I haven't learned it completely. And it wasn't always easy. But that was a good horizon broadening experience. Another thing is that Dorcas and I spent all day every day together, and that was really good. At first, it was a bit of an adjustment. We learned how to work together in ways that we never had before. We spent lots and lots of time on the road. And that gave us time to dream about our future, to think about what we wanted to do, where we wanted to be going. And it was a valuable, valuable time of clarifying, you know, some of what our core values are, what some of the things are that we want our lives to be about. To think about dreams and vision for our future and where we want to be headed. On the literature side, I was exposed to a number of books that dealt with issues of vision building and leadership and just kind of making your life work, making your life being purposeful about making your life count for something, and that has really impacted the way that I think and the way that I live. Overall, I think our time living in Colorado was not always easy or fun, but we would not trade those experiences. We certainly hope that the books we sold have made a positive impact on the people that read them, and I'm sure that they did. We know that our interactions with the receivers that we worked with has blessed both of us. And it's exciting to realize that just by living, that just by being, by exemplifying Christ, we paint a little clearer picture of him to the people that we relate to. But ultimately for us, we feel like one of the main reasons God called us where he did was because he wanted to put us in a position where he could work on us. And I wonder if maybe that isn't how it often is. That we receive the most when we give it, when we give the most. And I'll just close with a quote from Michael W. Smith that applies here, but I think to just a lot of the way we live. He says, "Love isn't love until you give it away."
Well, it was hard for me, too, to pick out a particular story just by itself, and so I plan to be doing some generalizations a little like Shane did here. And it was interesting how some of our thoughts intersected with what Joel said. One of the things that impresses me a lot about India is the vast cultural difference between us here and those people in India. I remember distinctly when we traveled in Europe back in 1989, the impression that I got of America as being just kind of an upstart, renegade, cocky, arrogant people. I think Paul's could probably resonate with some of those sentiments. And when I think of the culture or the history that we have, Hutchinson here was founded, I think, in 1872, and that would have made Hutchinson, what, 46 years old when Brother Irvin was born. And our perspective is just really small. I remember the 100-year celebration back in 1972, if I'm remembering the dates right. When we were in Europe, we slept in a hotel that was built in either the 1300 years. I mean, in the 13th to 14th century, if I could have said right. And here in America, we tend to shutter schools and bulldoze buildings that are maybe 50 or 75 years old. But then when I think of India, there's just another complete dimension of depth of history compared to either the U.S. or Western Europe. I've asked this question before, probably, but is India mentioned in the Bible? Daryl says yes. Where is it? The first verse in the book of Esther, talking about the extension of, was it the Persian Empire, whichever it was, went to India to the east. That's interesting. There's another reference when Solomon, I think in 1 Kings 10, talked about where these ships from Tarshish came in every 3 years, and they returned with peacocks and apes and ivory or something like that. Peacocks are native to India. So it's very likely that there was already a culture that they were tying into back then. One thing about the culture in India is the caste system, and this, though it's officially maybe not part of their system, the stratifying of culture, of people in those cultures, is still very much alive. Often these castes tend to do, or these people tend to do what their parents before them were done. It's like they were predisposed to be builders. These are the builder caste people, or the people in this certain caste, and they're the builders. You see a lot of women working on construction sites, things that our liberated women here would probably not do. They're doing the hard manual labor right alongside the men. Probably one of the lowest of these untouchables were the human scavengers, those people whose job was to go around in the mornings or wherever and pick up the human wastes of their neighbors and collect them. But there's just something about this caste system that people were predisposed to be subjected to that because that's what karma had dictated or whatever. Well, and there's the hope that if some way they do well in this life, maybe in the next existence they will be able to move up a few notches. And conversely, if they aren't, that in the next life you know, they may be relegated to a lower state, that of a lowly animal or whatever. But it's interesting to me, this whole caste system, I think, helps to give validity and rise to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Because in Christ, all are equal. And there's something beautiful about that. And I think of the words of Isaiah in 61:1, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon Lord God is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound." And Jesus quoted that in Luke 4 in one of our recent Sunday school lessons. Another area in the culture chasm is the hygiene issues. You know, the sanitation infrastructure in India isn't overly developed. And you think about 1.18 billion people and just the infrastructure that's needed to deal with that on a daily basis. India's way of dealing with that leaves some of us Westerners a bit squeamish and wistful sometimes, but it's a part of life. There's reserve with other people. You know, the Latin culture where we were in Nicaragua tended to be a very touchy-feely kind of a warm type of a culture. In India, especially in public, these people tend to show a lot of reserve. You know, there's cultural norms to uphold. I read in the paper once when I was over there about a policeman, I think, that observed a couple kissing in the park, and they were duly fined, as I recall. And this would have seemed just a bit foreign to the culture in Nicaragua. The divorce rate in India is extremely low. If there are marital problems, at one of our last trips over, someone was explaining how they have kind of a community neighborhood accountability that kicks in and tries to help this couple that's struggling. And it's an interesting set of dynamics that kick in. And ironically, the liberated West, or the Christian America or whatever, if what they see depicted on Hollywood is our norm, or the norm for Christians or Christian America, we come with a significant disadvantage when we come to preach the gospel if we're associated with that kind of thing. There's food and there's table manners. People in India eat with their fingers, eat with their right hands, and this can leave an American pretty messy by the time he's done. The food is generally fairly spicy. If you happen to like curry, ginger, garlic, cumin, chili, peppers, turmeric, you're in luck. If you don't, your visit in India can seem like a pretty long visit. English influence in India is very noticeable. There's usually a tea break somewhere in the morning or where we have been, and in the afternoon, often they will serve a chai, a sweet tea with milk in it. Some of these issues reminds me of what the missionary was telling us about. It's not only where he leads, I'll follow, but it's what he feeds, I'll swallow. Church reverence and manners. In many places in India, you're the honored guest. You're the white person from way off somewhere. And it's common that as they're introducing you or at some point, they will put a garland of flowers around your neck. And usually you sit up front facing the congregation. None of that slouching in the back row and waiting. Well, you get up to speak and you're wanting to take off this bouquet of marigolds before it stains your white shirt. But also, when you come into the church building, often you take your shoes off at the door as kind of a sign of reverence, respect. Okay, you're sitting in front of the church now, and all of these people have a chance to really scope out these visitors and get a good look at them. Well, you may be fighting jet lag, but it's not a good place to be sleeping. And if you're not the first person that's speaking, or maybe it's a long all-day program, this can go on and on and on. And, you know, you're kind of there shuffling and think, well, at least I can change positions. Maybe you want to cross your legs or do something. And crossing their legs, your legs, incidentally, can be seen as an object of pride or, you know, something, whatever. So you kind of shuffle and move around and just wish sometimes that you were somewhere else. Well, I had probably one of my biggest cultural faux pas in a church service over there is when we were in Puri, and We were in a chapel, and there with the pastor's conference, we were sitting off on the side, as I recall. I don't think David was there that time. And this is maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and I was already getting fairly farsighted, and it's hard for me to read with stuff up close to me. And I discovered, as I was sitting there, probably a bit bored, I could put my Bible on the floor, and I could actually open it up, and I could read it just fine, right down there. Well, I assume I was continuing to be a bit bored, and I discovered after some time I could hook my toe in here, the other toe in there. You know, remember I had my shoes off. And I could move this thing around and adjust it just kind of how I wanted to, you know, just kind of like a RC toy or something. My good friend Vidya at some point, don't do that. I had made two mistakes. Here I had God's holy word down on the floor. And second, I was touching it with my unclean feet. And, you know, something that I had no malice intended. But I wonder how many of those kinds of things that we do in those different cultural situations. Well, India has not only its distinct culture, and it's a culture that it's hard for us to get our minds wrapped around sometimes, but there is a general darkness in the land that is staggering. 2%, I think statistics say, approximately 2%, 2 to 3 maybe, that would have some profession or be classified as Christians. 82%, I'm kind of going by memory, I didn't look up some of these statistics, people, Hindus, and then maybe 10 or 12% Muslim. You know, how many of you walked into a room or a building and just kind of felt an oppression, a sense of darkness? In India, there is a lot of darkness just across the country. At night, you travel along, you see these little Hindu temples. Here's one, there's one, there's one. Maybe there's a bell ringing, or there's lights on, or there's some flashing, or whatever. People going in and out of there and giving their sacrifices or making their prayers or whatever they do there. Hindus claim up to 3 million gods. I really don't know how they could come up with 3 million. I mean, I don't know. Do they just, you know, lump off 100,000 in this general category or what? I don't know how it comes off. But one of the gods that figures prominently is the god Shiva, or the destroyer god, that basically I think we would see as the devil or as Satan. You know, the Hindus in their homes, they have a lot of little idols or pictures set up in their homes, and the homes, the families have their individual gods that they follow or that they worship or that they have claimed. You know, last year when we were visiting with the Singapogus in the Hyderabad area, east of Hyderabad, I think, they took us on a tour. They wanted us to go visit this special Hindu shrine, destination place, whatever. And it was a major complex, and people would go there to do their worship, their whatever. It was just a sad situation. People would make their pilgrimages and go up that hill, go up there and do their sacrifices, do whatever they wanted to up there. But our host wanted us to see this darkness. The driver, who had been a Hindu before, I think, was hesitant to take us up there. And even the two ladies that went with us, it was like they were hesitant to go up there with us. But it was as if you were there that you could just sense the power of darkness. And it was a very, very sad, almost a palpable situation. It was a bright day, but you could just about feel the darkness around you. Well, later we went. Unfortunately, we got out of that area and went. Maybe I should just mention that these people have a goal of setting up churches in 7 villages, I think it is, around that area. And afterward, we were able to go and visit in some of the churches, and it was just kind of like a different perspective. And as is often the case in those situations, you're asked to speak just kind of impromptu. Oh, by the way, brother, could you have some words for us? You know, those kinds of things. And Judy was recalling, we were kind of rehearsing some of this last night and haven't gone over it for for a long time, but as it seemed that God just kind of injected the words and the thoughts, and I was led to speak about light, the comparison between light and darkness, and how those scriptures just kind of fell into my mind and able to speak light in a dark land. We followed with a prayer time. Judy remembers feeling like in this little service we've been privileged to stand on holy ground. You know, it's humbling to be involved in God's work and to feel that in spite of our weaknesses and our problems, that he is able to use unfit vessels to minister, to bring hope and truth. The village that we have our pastor's conference in is down on the seacoast, and there's a lighthouse there. And I think ideally we as Christians are light. We're a beacon, we're a focal point, a reference point that the dark world can hook on to. You realize that light and darkness cannot coexist, because when light enters, darkness flees. And I think that's beautiful. Light supersedes darkness. As Christians, we have been privileged to carry the light, and let's do that with joy and with care. India is dark, let's bear God's light to them. In Harold's little email, he was asking, how can we pray for you in preparation for the next seminar? And let me mention two things relating to what I said. Pray that the Holy Spirit could bridge the cultural gaps. You know, I firmly believe that the gospel is applicable and adaptable to any culture. Pray that God would give us wisdom as we prepare the topics. I hope to be sharing on the Christian pastor's home. And there are things that we enjoy that may not be right or wrong, but there are things teachings in the scripture that apply to any culture, and that God would give wisdom to know how to bring out those things that can be helpful without just dumping culture on them. And then in illustrations, that God would give illustrations that would help to bridge those gaps. I think the missiological term is taking things from the unknown to the known through illustrations, and I think that often is helpful. And pray that we could be fit light bearers. You know, the world is dark. Satan's domain is oppressive. And sometimes we really sense that darkness. Sometimes we sense it in a greater way than in other times. Satan, I don't think, takes lightly invasion of light into his dark territory. Just pray for our protection, that our light would be pure, that we could be armed and protected with Christ's armor, for that's what keeps us safe. The seminar this fall is scheduled for November 14 through 16, Lord willing. And David and I plan to be going from here, as well as it looks like David's brother Abe from Minnesota. Their churches are involved with some work in South India, and there's a possibility that we would be going from Orissa State to South India, spending several days with him following the seminar before we come back. But just pray that we could be light, and that we could do it in ways that don't offend culture, but that would build bridges in the culture of the Bible. Thank you.
Thank you, Lowell, Shane, and Joel. Ooh. I wanted to say Grant, and I knew that wasn't right. It was a learning experience for all of us, I think. Food's ready? Okay. Got some announcements here. I think Sanford, we talked to Sanford about having some activities for the children. Do you have a time when you want to start, meet? Around 1 o'clock, okay. We talked to Michael Utzi, and he's not here yet, about setting up for softball. Titus? Would you be available to help us with planning softball, arranging that? Okay, I appreciate that. Michael may be coming yet. We think he's coming, and the two of you can maybe work together. It's time for church directory updates. We need your information. If your birthday changed, well, I make note of that. Or any other, primarily emails, or you moved from one location to another. Well, we need to know that to keep it current, to keep it informative. Any other announcements?
Kansas Youth Corps is